This is a talk by Ajahn Sumedho from the Anthology, Volume 1, Pieces of Simple Step, Chapter 4, page 35. It's a talk titled The Five Hindrances. In meditation, you develop an understanding of the five hindrances, how when one of them is present, you investigate it, understand it, accept its presence, and learn how to deal with it. Sometimes you can just tell it to go away, and it goes. Sometimes you have to allow it to be there until it wears out. We have subtle ways of being averse to that which is unpleasant, and we tend not to be very honest about our intentions. As soon as something unpleasant arises, our habit is to try to move away from it or destroy it. But so long as we do this, we don't have any samadhi or concentration. It is only when these five hindrances are absent, or when we are no longer attached to them, that we find any peace of mind or a concentrated heart. Only in the moment when a hindrance actually arises can you really penetrate it and have insight. You may have noticed that although you listen to teachings and gain a profound understanding of the Dhamma, you can still become angry or frightened or feel desire for things. When an actual situation arises, you are not mindful. You tend to resist or resent or just judge. I spent my first year as a samanera living in a monastery in northeast Thailand. I was not required to do anything other than just live in a little hut. The monks brought me food every day, and as I could speak no Thai and nobody else spoke any English, I didn't have to talk to anyone. The senses were not stimulated to any great extent, so sensory deprivation set in, and I found myself becoming very tranquil, so tranquil, in fact, that I attained great states of bliss and ecstasy. I'd sit on the porch of my little kuti, and tears of love would well up in my eyes for the mosquitoes which were biting me. I could think in abstract terms about all beings everywhere and feel great love for them, too. I even forgave my enemies and those who had caused me suffering in the past. I could entertain these high-minded feelings for all beings, mainly because I was not having to live with them. Then one day I had to go to the immigration authorities to renew my visa. I had to travel to a place called Nong Khai, which is where you cross the Mekong River to go to Laos. Because of my new sensitive state, as I walked to the town, I could see things more clearly than ever before. I saw the sorrow and anguish in the faces of the people. And when I walked into the immigration office, I felt an iron curtain of hatred forming in front of me. I found out later that the leading monk of the province had ordered the officials to give me a visa. This was not quite in line with the regulations, and so it had forced the officials into a position that was really quite unfair. Because of this, they had a definite aversion towards me and would not grant me a visa, which was very confusing for me because of my heightened state of awareness. The feeling of great love I had for all beings began to fade away very quickly. By the time I got back to the monastery, I was in a frantic mental state. I went to my kuti and spent the next 3 days just calming down all the feelings that had been aroused during that hour's visit to the immigration authorities. After a few months, I became very fond of the isolated life. There's something very romantic about living that way. It's so peaceful not to be exposed to the misery of people or have your senses excited by their actions. Nature itself is very peaceful, very pleasant to be with. Even the mosquitoes, which you might think must be terribly annoying, are not really anywhere near as annoying as people are. It takes much less skill to live with mosquitoes than with another person. I became very attached to that way of life, but after a few months, I had to go to Bangkok. I remember sitting in the train on the way from Nong Khai to the capital. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I just sat there with my high-minded thoughts about helping all beings, dedicating my life to their welfare, and thinking about the Dhamma and the Buddha. I was permeated by an overwhelming state of bliss. What a wonderful state to be in, I thought. But the noisy, confusing, and unpleasant city put paid to all that. In half an hour, my mind was in terrible confusion. From these experiences, I began to see that the way to enlightenment did not lie in being shut off from everything that was unpleasant, but rather through learning to understand all that we find unpleasant or difficult. Those particular conditions have been put there for a purpose, to teach us. No matter how little we want them and would like things to be otherwise, somehow they will persist in our lives until we have understood and transcended them. My hermit life ended soon after that. I was going to train as a bhikkhu and would live with Ajahn Chah at a monastery where I wouldn't be allowed the luxury of ascetic practice. I'd have to live in a community of monks and perform my duties, learn all the disciplinary rules that bhikkhus have to learn, and live under the authority of someone else. By this time, I was quite willing to accept all that. I realized that, in fact, it was exactly what I needed. I certainly did not need any more ascetic, ecstatic, blissful states which disappeared as soon as anything annoying happened. At Wat Pa Pong, I found a constant stream of annoying conditions coming at me, which gave me a chance of learning to deal with the five hindrances. At the other monasteries in Thailand where I'd lived, being a Westerner had meant that I could expect to have the best of everything. I could also get out of doing the work and other mundane things that the other monks were expected to do by saying something like, "I'm busy meditating now. I don't have time to sweep the floor. Let someone else sweep it. I'm a serious meditator." But when I arrived at Wat Pa Pong and people said, "He's an American. He can't eat the kind of food we eat," Ajahn Chah said, "He'll have to learn." And when I didn't like the meditation hut I was given and asked for another that I liked better, Ajahn Chah said, "No." I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and attend morning chanting and meditation. There were readings from the Vinaya, too. They were read in Thai, which at first I didn't understand, and even when I could understand the language, they were excruciatingly boring. You'd hear about how a monk who has a rent in his robe so many inches above the hem must have it sewn up before dawn, and I kept thinking, this isn't what I went forth for. I was caught up in these meticulous rules, trying to figure out whether the hole in my robe was 4 inches above the hem or not, and whether I should have to sew it up before dawn. Or they'd read about making a sitting cloth and how the monks should know that the border had to be so many inches wide. And a monk would say, "Well, I've seen a sitting cloth with a border different from that." The monks would even argue about the border of the sitting cloth. "Let's talk about serious things," I'd think, "things of importance like the Dhamma." When it came to the pettiness of everyday life and living with people of many different temperaments, problems, and characters, whose minds were not necessarily as inspired as mine seemed to be at that time, I felt great depression. Then I was faced with the five hindrances as a practical reality. There was no escape. I had to learn the lesson that they were there to teach. You would be surprised at some of the forms that the first hindrance, sense desire, takes for monks. As a layman, you can spend time trying to seek out the objects that suit you, but because monks live a celibate life and have few possessions, we find our greed accumulates over things like robes or alms bowls. We are allowed one meal a day, so a lot of greed and aversion may arise with regard to food. At Wat Pa Pong, we had to accept whatever hut we were given, so sometimes you were fortunate and had a really nice one, and sometimes the one you had was not very nice. But then you could watch the aversion that arose if you were given something that you didn't like, or the pleasure if you were given something you liked. I became obsessed with robes for the first few months. The color of the robe, believe it or not. At the monastery where I had lived before, they wore robes in a bright, knock-your-eyes-out kind of orange, which was not my color. At Wat Pa Pong, they wore a kind of ochre yellow or brownish-colored robe, and I developed a great desire for this kind of robe. At first, they would not give it to me. I had to wear one of those knock-your-eyes-out orange robes, and I became very greedy for new ones, big robes. The robes in Thailand never fitted me properly, but at Wat Pa Pong, they'd make them to your size. You'd have a tailor-made robe. Finally, after a month or so, Ajahn Chah suggested that a monk make me these robes. But then I became obsessed by the color. I did not want it too brown, and I did not want too much red in it. I went through a lot of sorrow and despair trying to get the right color for the robe. Although we could not eat anything in the afternoon, certain things are allowed in the Vinaya, and one was sugar. So I found myself having a fantastic obsession with sweets, though before I had not really cared about sweets at all. At Wat Pa Pong, they'd have a sweet drink in the afternoon once every 2 or 3 days, and you began to anticipate the day when they would give you tea or coffee with sugar in it. Sometimes they'd even make cocoa. When word got round that we'd have cocoa that evening, I could not think about anything else. I did not find sexual desire any problem in those days, because my obsessions were with sugar and sweets. I'd go to bed at night and dream about bakeries. I'd be sitting at the table just about to put one of the stickiest pastries in my mouth. Then I'd wake up and think, if only I'd had just one bite. Before I went to Thailand, I had spent a few years in Berkeley, California, where it was pretty much the case of doing your own thing. There was no sense of having to obey anybody or live under a discipline of any sort. But at Wat Bapong, I had to live following a tradition that I did not always like or approve of, in a situation where I had no authority whatsoever. I did not mind obeying Ajahn Chah. I respected him. But sometimes I had to obey monks I did not like very much, and who I thought were inferior to me. The Thai monks were very critical of me at Wat Bapong, whereas in other monasteries they had praised me all the time. They used to say, "How beautiful you are, and what beautiful skin you have." They liked white skin, and though my skin is not really very beautiful, it is white. At Wat Bapong, however, the monks would say, "You have ugly skin with brown spots." I was in my 30s at the time and still sensitive to the aging process. And they asked, "How old are you?" I'd say, 33. And they'd say, "Really? We thought you were at least 60. Then they would criticize the way I walked, saying, "You don't walk right. You're not very mindful when you walk." And I'd take my bag, they gave me a bag, and just dump it down, thinking, "This can't be very important." But they'd say, "Put your bag down right. You take it like this, fold it over, and then you set it down beside you like that." The way I ate, the way I walked, the way I talked, everything was criticized and made fun of. But something made me stay on and endure through it. I learned how to conform to a tradition and a discipline, which took a number of years because there was always strong resistance. But I began to understand the wisdom of the discipline of the Vinaya, which is not all that apparent on reading the Vinaya scriptures. You might develop an opinion on the traditions and the Vinaya itself, thinking, "This rule isn't necessary." You could spend hours of your day rationalizing this opinion, saying, "This is the 20th century, these things are not necessary." And you would watch the discontent and proliferation going on inside you, and you ask yourself, "Is this suffering?" You keep watching your reactions to being corrected, criticized, or praised. Over the years, equanimity seemed to develop. You found that anger, annoyance, and aversion began to fade out. And when your mind no longer inclines towards dwelling in aversion, you begin to have some joy and some peace of mind. As I gained confidence in the practice and the teacher, and then the monastery, I developed a kind of obsessive attachment to them. I couldn't see any faults in them, and I felt that everybody should be following them. When people came to the monastery, I'd feel it was my duty to convert them. I can understand how missionaries must feel. When you feel very inspired, very attached to something that has helped you and given you happiness and insight, you feel compelled to tell everybody about it, whether they want to hear it or not. This was all right as long as the Westerners who came agreed with me. That was nice. I could inspire them and they would feel the same sense of dedication, and we would reinforce each other. We could get together and talk about our tradition and our teacher being the best, and how we had discovered something wonderful. But then, inevitably, some negative American or Englishman would come to the monastery and not accept any of this. This happened very strongly in about my fifth year there, when an American came who had been at the Zen Center in San Francisco. He proceeded to find fault with Ajahn Chah, with Wat Bapong, with Theravada Buddhism, with the Vinaya, with everything. He was quite an intelligent person, and he certainly had a lot of experience in going from one teacher to another, one ashram to another, from one monastery to another, and finding fault with them. He put doubt in the minds of people. Maybe there is a better way to do it, a quicker way. Maybe Ajahn Chah is an old-fashioned nobody. There was said to be a teacher in India who was giving meditation courses where people became sotapannas almost immediately, making people think, "I don't know if I'm a sotapanna yet or not. If I could have a teacher come and tell me, verify, it would be really nice to know where I am in my meditation. Ajahn Chah wouldn't tell you this." So I felt strong aversion arise towards this American. I felt the need to tear down every other type of Buddhism, every other teacher, every possible alternative to Wat Bapong and its ways. I became very critical, and every time somebody said, "I know a better system," rather than listen to why it was allegedly better, I would immediately find every possible way in which it was worse. So I developed a habit of tearing down other teachers and traditions, but this brought me no joy. I began to see the suffering in always having to defend something and tear down anything that threatens the security you find in attachment. If you never really understand doubt, the nature of uncertainty in your own mind, you may be overwhelmed by it, and when someone says, "I know a better way, a quicker way," you start doubting. Maybe there is a better way, a quicker way. If this better way was described in very rational terms, you would think, "Well, yes, maybe that's the way to do it." But when you are attached and feel loyal to your teacher, you think, "I can't do that. It's better to do it the slow way and be sure." So when you start to put down anybody who suggests there is a better or quicker way, but the important thing to understand is the doubting mind. I saw that it was not up to me to decide which was the best or the quickest way to do anything, but to understand my own uncertainty. So I began to investigate the mental state that arose when doubt was put into my mind, and after a while I began to accept any kind of doubt, regarding it as a changing condition. Once when I was in Bangkok, people were comparing religions, and I was trying to be very tolerant and accept that all religions were equally good, even though I did not really think so. But I would always try to say something good about how the goal is the same, and that we should love the Christians and try to have metta, loving kindness, for all Christians. But I really felt that Buddhism was better. One day this bothered me because I thought, what if somebody asks you, which is the best religion? What would you say? Well, I'd say Buddhism. Suddenly it became very clear that that was only an opinion, and that opinions were not permanent conditions. They were not self, and you did not need to have one or believe in one. I did not have to be the authority, the one who said this was better than that. So I no longer felt any obligation to think about this or to try to figure it out. It became clear that all I had to do was to be aware of the desire to know and of the ability to say, this is better than that. Another time, several years ago, I became obsessed with jealousy. As I was the senior monk, I felt I had to set an example of perfect behavior, and I began to feel jealous if other monks were praised. Somebody might say, this monk is better than Sumedho, and I'd feel a tremendous sense of jealousy arise in my mind. Jealousy is a kind of competitiveness, a feeling that you always have to hold your own in front of everybody else. But then I found that I did not like jealousy. It was a most unpleasant condition. So I tended to repress it. I would practice sympathetic joy, mudita, when somebody said, that monk is better than Sumedho. I'd say to myself, isn't that wonderful? He's better than me. Or, oh, how glad I am for that person. He's better off than I am. But I'd still feel jealous. So I realized I had to look at the emotion, and saw that the problem was that I was always trying to get rid of it. I decided to bring it up more. I decided concentrating on jealousy. I'd think of every possible thing that would arouse jealousy. I kept looking at the feeling of jealousy and observing its changing nature, and after a while it began to fade out. As it disappeared, I could see that it was only a natural condition of the mind, and that it was not self. Sleepiness or mental dullness is another good teacher, which appears when you no longer feel inspired by your monastic life. When you've just entered the Sangha, you feel a lot of inspiration, at least I did, and you have a lot of energy, but afterwards you find yourself becoming very dull mentally. You start falling asleep when sitting or listening to talks. You sit and concentrate on the dullness, just letting the mind go into a dull mental state without putting any effort in, or you try to resist this mental dullness. On the moon days in Thailand, we used to have to sit up all night till dawn. At first, like a typical competitive American, I wanted to look good in front of others, so I'd sit there and, through sheer willpower, hold myself up all night. I'd see some Thai monks sinking down, almost falling over, and contempt would arise. I am better than that. I won't allow myself to give in to sleepiness or dullness. But after a while, the willpower would fade out, and I'd find myself sinking down and falling on my face on the floor. I would feel aversion to this mental state and make myself stay awake by willpower. When this happens, you find yourself going into a state where you don't know what's going on and you start hallucinating. So I reflected on this hindrance and that the real problem was that it was something I didn't like. Trying to get rid of something you don't want is dukkha, so I thought, I'll just accept it. I'll investigate the feelings of sleepiness and dullness. And though I thought I would fall asleep and disgrace myself in front of all the other monks, I found that one can concentrate on the feeling of sleepiness itself. I would contemplate the sensation around the eyes and the feeling in the body, observing the mental condition and my habitual resistance to it. In this way, that hindrance soon ceased being a problem for me. In life, wisdom arises within us when we understand the things we are experiencing here and now. You don't have to do anything special. You don't have to experience all kinds of extreme pain in order to transcend pain. The pain in your ordinary life is enough to urge you towards enlightenment. We can regard all these feelings of hunger or thirst, of restlessness, jealousy, or fear, of lust and greed and sleepiness as teachers, rather than resenting them and saying, "What did I do to deserve this?" You should say, "Thank you very much. I'll have to learn this lesson someday. I might as well do it now rather than put it off." I like that talk just because of Lungpor's emphasis on investigating the hindrances and making an honest assessment of whether you have them or not, and rather than living from an ideal. Just that was really striking to me.
You made a mental note once of him. He was talking about the hindrances of where you talk about hindrances is a problem. You call them the five ordeals.
The five ordeals, rather than viewing them as problems.
Have you seen them as something you can learn from?
Actually, sort of question, reflection about the previous day's reading. I was a little cautious about Ajahn Yananamo says. It seemed to say that you can judge how well your meditation goes by how much time you're actually concentrated, such that if you spend 4 hours meditating, but you're actually focused only 1 minute, it's like you only meditated 1 minute. And I'm not quite sure I understand what he's getting at there. Or maybe there'd be another perspective on that. I'm curious what other people have to say about
that. My take on that was, in the context he was talking about, was putting forth effort and energy in practice and looking at developing mindfulness. And so I think he said if you're not developing awareness, you're not developing mindfulness, you're just allowing yourself to just drift off and fantasize and not putting any effort in, then even though you've sat for 4 hours, but you're mentally asleep, then you weren't meditating. You weren't putting forth any effort. That's, I think, what he was. Kind of, he approached that from one or two different times, kind of saying that same thing. It was my take.
I thought it was like if you're sitting and not putting forth the mental effort, at least trying, then you're not meditating. It's not like you have to be, I don't think he ever said you have to be in samadhi or else it was completely wasted, but at least you're trying to keep your meditation object rather than just letting it go completely.
Yeah, I agree. That's my understanding too. It's not, just as you say, it's not that you have to be with the breath 100% of the time or with your object or, moving into samadhi, but making the effort, that moment when you find yourself lost and you wake to that moment of being, oh, I just drifted for 20 minutes. That's a moment of mindfulness. And that's what you just, that's the habit, the returning to that awareness of what the state is, whether it's kusala or akusala, you know, is meditating, as far as I understand.
Maybe just listen to, I'd like to consider the talk we just heard. I mean, there's not, when Pasamedo is, you know, puts Dhamma Vichaya prominent, he's always aware of what that mental state is. I mean, that whole talk really had very little to do with samadhi, but hindrance, you know, being aware of the state of the mind. And if you're constantly applying your mind in that way, you'll overcome those problems. And whether or not it's specifically with the point of a breath or samadhi or your feet touching the ground, not quite as important.
Actually, in my understanding, and also is that when you do deal with the hindrances, like Ajahn Sumedho was talking about in that talk, when you do that, then, and you work on lessening the hindrances and sending them into abeyance, then it's not like you have to work on samadhi. It just that's what happens when you deal with the hindrances and let them go, understand them and let them go. Then the result is very easy samadhi. You don't have to work on it.
Listen to, I kind of wonder with Ajahn Yanadhammo, because I think he also helped edit or translated the autobiography of Ajahn Tate in the early days. And I think Ajahn Tate goes into the Volga state, that kind of state of, because he very specifically mentions that, not the wording of it, but getting into a meditative state where there's no effort being put in, it feels very peaceful, but there's no wisdom arising from it. And I think Ajahn Yana would even say that, you know, it's not necessarily it's not meditation, but it's not profitable. You know, it might be, like temporarily, it might be a reprieve from some suffering that you're feeling or suppressing the hindrances, but it's not uprooting. And then Ajahn Tate, he goes to Ajahn Mun, he actually went to his teacher, I think maybe Ajahn Singh Tong, and he told him that he shouldn't be going into that state, and he disagreed. So he sent off for 2 or 3 years looking for Ajahn Mun. Ajahn Mun basically told him, no, your teacher was right. You need to abandon that type of practice and start investigating the hindrances.
Yeah, I remember Ajahn Mun told Ajahn Tate that he has to cultivate mindfulness of the body. And Ajahn Tate thought, why is that? I don't have any lust or I don't have any coarse defilements. And Ajahn Mun said, it doesn't matter. It's not about that. It's about insight into anatta. I think Lumbo Cao also had a thing where he could meditate all night, but he had no idea what happened or where he was. He could sit bolt upright all night, but had no memory of it. And Ajahn Mun said, you have sati without sampajanya. Most of us don't have that problem. not raised up to the level of having that particular problem.